Say it to you.
May it please the court, Mr. Gina Ariano, and the office for the petitioner.
May it please the court, my name is Sabrina Arellano, and I, along with Mitchell Rosenheim of the law firm of Aiken Gump in San Antonio,
please.
We represent the petitioners in this case, Charles and Billy Sider. The Siders are individuals who financed the sale of their own home to the respondents in this case, the Vatias. The financing of the sale was originally done in the form of two notes, which were both dated on July 20th of 1981. One in the amount of $37,000with a 15% interest rate, and the other in the amount of $85,000 with a 14% interest rate. Both notes were secured by accompanying deeds of trust. The Vatias defaulted on their obligations under the note, and although the Siders originally planned to foreclose on the property, they agreed to enter into a modification and extension document, which is involved in this lawsuit. That document was dated July 25th of 1984, and it rearranged the manner of payment and extended the terms of payment, also carried forward the liens on the property. The modification and extension document contained a $20 a day late penalty provision, which is the focus of this lawsuit. The Vatias again defaulted on their payments under the modification and extension agreement. And in September of 1985, the Siders posted the property for foreclosure. On September 27th of 1985, Joe Vatia, filed this lawsuit alleging usury as a grounds for a temporary restraining order. The temporary restraining order was granted, but the trial court denied a temporary injunction. The Fourth Court of Appeals on appeal reversed that and remanded with instructions to enter an injunction pending the determination of the merits of the usury claim. We, in August of 1986, filed a motion for partial summary judgment on this, alleging both that there was no usury as a matter under both federal and state law. And Judge Solomon Kassab heard the motion for summary judgment and granted it on the ground that the federal preemption, which is contained in Section 501 of the Depository Institutions Deregulation and Monetary Control Act of 1980, preempted state interest ceilings in this situation and thus precluded their claim of usury. The Fourth Court of Appeals reversed Judge Kassam's judgment on two grounds. One, that the controverting affidavit of Joe Vatia, which was filed in response to the motion for summary judgment, raised a fact issue under state usury law, and also that the federal preemption did not, in its words, preempt usurious late charges. I have briefed in my application for writ of error the argument on state law. We contend that there was no contracted for usurious interest and that the only allegation of charged usurious interest, there was none made ever in the petition or the first amended petition. The Vatias raised for the first time in the rebuttal portion of their oral argument before the Court of Appeals the possibility that there was a charge of usurious interest based on a statement in the controverting affidavit. I have briefed that point and believe that the fact issue was not sufficiently raised because it was not pointed out in the written response before the Court of Appeals or before the trial court. With regard to the federal preemption argument, the Court of Appeals, in making its decision, didn't decide whether or not Texas opted out of the federal preemption. It just held that late charges, in any event, are not included within the federal preemption. The respondents have contended both that Texas did opt out of the federal preemption and also that late charges are not includable in that preemption. I don't believe there's really any persuasive authority that Texas opted out of the federal preemption, and I'm not going to spend a lot of my argument on that point, but I'd like to go briefly over some provisions of the federal statute. Section 501 of DDMAC, as the statute is called, removes all state usury ceilings for loans which are made by qualified lenders during the preemption period if they are secured by a first lien on residential real estate. I don't believe the respondents have contended at all that the Siders were not qualified lenders. I think they fall clearly within the definition, which says any individual who finances the sale or exchange of residential real property, which such individual owns, and which such individual occupies or has occupied as its principal place of residence. The preemption became effective on April 1st of 1980, and it was permanent unless the state opted out within the required three-year period. The language that granted the states the right to opt out said that the state must either amend its constitution or adopt a law which, quote, either explicitly and by its terms opts out of the preemption. Respondents have argued that the revision of state usury law, which was done under House Bill 1228, constitutes an implicit, if not an explicit, opt-out of the provision. I think that this argument has to fail for several reasons. One is that the language of the federal preemption statute itself says explicit, and there is no explicit language in the Texas usury law. Also, the Texas Mortgage Bankers Association has filed an amicus brief in this case in which they point out that Representative Messer, who sponsored the legislation before the House, stated in testimony before the House of Representatives Committee on Financial Institutions that by enacting this or changing the revising the usury law, Texas did not intend to opt out of the federal preemption. I think the real question before this court is whether or not in Texas late charges are included in the federal preemption, and we submit that they are. Texas, of course, defines interest as compensation for the use, forbearance, or detention of money. It does not separately regulate late charges as do a number of other states. Instead, it just defines it as interest and includes it in the calculation of the percentage rate to determine whether or not there is usury. Section 501 of the federal preemption stated that it was removing all state usury ceilings on interest, on discount points, finance charges, and other charges. And our argument is really a fairly simple one, is that late charges are defined as interest in Texas, and that is both under the language of the statute that refers to detention of money and also under a case, Dixon v. Brooks, that we cited in our brief. And because the federal law preempted state interest ceilings, we believe that late charges are included in that preemption. Respondents have raised several sentences from the legislative history of the Federal Act in support of their position that late charges are not preempted. That section of legislative history reads, in exempting mortgage loans from state usury limitations, the committee intends to exempt only those limitations that are included in the annual percentage rate. The committee does not intend to exempt limitations on prepayment charges, attorney fees, late charges, or similar limitations designed to protect borrowers. Before the Court of Appeals and in their initial response to this application for writ of error, respondents argued that the second quoted sentence that talks about late charges means that in effect late charges are never preempted by the federal statute. But I think when you look at the second sentence of that legislative history in the context of the first, it's clear that that second sentence is referring to states which separately regulate late charges and similar charges. Those states that separately regulate late charges, I have looked through the statutory provisions, and those states generally define interest as for the use or forbearance, not the detention of money. So I think that all fits within the argument.
How do you handle this quote, though, from the legislative history in Congress that's set out at page 3 of the CA slip opinion, that in exempting mortgage loans from state usury limitations and so forth, the committee does not intend to exempt limitations on prepayment charges, attorney's fees, late charges, or similar limitations designed to protect borrowers?
Well, my argument on that, I believe, is that sentence has to refer, in the context of the first sentence, it has to refer to states that separately regulate late charges. In a state like Texas, where there is no separate regulation of late charges, there is no state limitation on late charges other than including them in the interest and then determining whether or not that interest is usurious. there is no separate regulation of it in Texas. I think that we have done a look through other states that may have ruled on this issue and have come up with only one case that seems to be on point. It is a case that is cited in our brief. It's called United Federal Savings and Loan Association versus Cage. And it held that federal law does not preempt the state determinations of what interest is. Now, in Louisiana, late charges are separately regulated, so it comes out somewhat differently than in Texas, but the relevant holding is that federal law doesn't attempt to define what's going to be included in a state definition of interest. And the statute in Texas refers to interest. I mean, the federal statute, I'm sorry, refers to interest. In a supplemental brief that the respondents filed last week, they've also raised the first quoted sentence of legislative history that's on page 3 of the Court of Appeals opinion, which states that the only charges that are exempted are those that are included in the annual percentage rate. And respondents argue that annual percentage rate in this context means annual percentage rate as it's defined by the Truth in Lending Act and by Regulation Z pursuant to that act. They argue that because late charges are not included in APR or finance charge calculations under the Texas the Truth in Lending Act and Regulation Z, that they are not included in the federal preemption. I think that their argument is legally incorrect for several reasons. One, the language of the statute does clearly refer to interest. There is no indication either in the statute or in the legislative history that Congress intended to preempt state determinations of what constitutes interest. To do that, I think, would in effect impose a federal definition of interest on the states. And I think my argument is supported by Cage and also by the fact that what Congress was concerned with was state-defined usury ceilings. It was not attempting to put in its own definition of interest, which would in effect limit the usefulness of the federal preemption if it said that only these things are interest. It looked to the state's definition of interest and said that that is preempted in certain covered loans by certain qualified lenders. Also, with regard to the APR, as defined under the Truth in Lending Act and Regulation Z, it's important to remember that that purpose of that statute is disclosure. It is not regulation of interest charges. And it applies only to consumer credit transactions, as that term is defined under the statute. There are a number of loans that would clearly fall, I think, within the ambit of the federal preemption that are not consumer credit transactions, and therefore they don't fall within the disclosure requirements of the Truth in Lending Act. The ciders themselves would not fall within this act because they are not in the business of regularly arranging for the extension of credit, and therefore they don't fall within the disclosure provisions of Truth in Lending Act or the APR calculations under that act. I have may be able to make my point a little more forcefully by referring to a Federal Home Loan Bank Board Office of General Counsel opinion, which I have attached as an appendix to a supplemental brief I filed. The Federal Home Loan Bank Board was charged by Congress with interpreting and issuing regulations regarding the statute. And in an opinion letter, which is S-64, dated June 9th of 1982, the Office of General Counsel stated its position that the applicability of the usury preemption of DITIMAC to contingent interest in the form of a percentage of cash flow produced by a multi-unit apartment complex. The requesting letter was from Texas, and it outlined a partnership's intent to acquire land for development of the complex with funds that would be provided by a state housing corporation. There would be revenue bonds sold by the state housing corporation, and then the bonds would be secured by a first lien on the property and sold to an institutional investor which was capable of making federally related loans. The proceeds from the bond sale were then going to be loaned to the partnership by the state housing corporation, and because there was a limit on the bond interest rate that was payable under state law, the partnership intended to grant the investor additional interest, contingent interest, in the form of a percentage of the cash flow of the complex. The letter of the Office of the General Counsel stated its opinion that if this form of interest, this contingent interest, would be considered interest in Texas, then it fell within the federal preemption. I think the letter is useful for two points. One is that the Office of General Counsel of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board was clearly looking to the state definition of interest. It said, we are not going to determine whether or not this contingent interest is interest under state law. But if it is interest, we believe that it falls within the federal preemption. I think that this clearly would not be a transaction that would fall under the APR disclosure requirements of the Consumer of the Truth in Lending Act and Regulation Z, and it's another argument that late charges would fall within the preemption, that there are forms of interest that are defined as interest under state law, but that are not included, that are included in the federal preemption, even though they're not considered under the annual percentage rate. And another letter opinion, S-91, which was issued on February 4th of 1986, the Federal Home Loan Bank Board considered charges imposed in connection with a federally related residential mortgage loan. And the requesting party had asked for the effect of the federal preemption on usury penalties under Article 5069-1.06. The Office of General Counsel addressed the effect of the federal preemption on the penalties and as applied, not quote, not only to interest charges, and those includable in the annual percentage rate, but also to other charges deemed to be interest under Texas law. And the letter concluded that all interest charges that were deemed to be interest were preempted along with those that were included in the annual percentage rate. I think that where this argument clearly leads is that the federal law preempted interest. It did not preempt APR. It looks to state law. It leaves to state law the determination of what is interest. And under Texas law, interest is defined to include, late charges are defined as interest, and therefore they fall within the federal preemption.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. We will now hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court and esteemed colleagues, my name is Luke Soles. I represent the respondents in this case, Joe Badia and Mrs. Badia. I have some charts behind me which I ask to leave the court to be distracted for a moment to put them on the easel, please. I have provided 8.5 by 11 copies of these charts to each person, each justice on the bench, and also to counsel, which was given to counsel sometime earlier, not just here, but earlier today. So reference may be made to those as well if these turn out to be hard to read. My submission today will cover these points, that the legislature of the state of Texas is constitutionally empowered to define and set interest rates, that the federal government passed a preemption statute, that the Texas legislature thereafter acted but not expressly to opt out, and that it is important to look to the legislative history of the Texas activities. That the legislative history of the federal statute is also critical and in fact dispositive of this case as to the late charge element. Our brief, we believe, fully responds to the contentions that the issues that we contracted for usurious interest and that sort of thing in the trial court were plainly raised in the motion, in the response to motion for summary judgment and the pleadings. But I may have time to talk about those as well. First, then, the Constitution of the State of Texas, Article 16, Section 11, plainly gives to the legislature of the state of Texas all the authority that the people give to anyone to define interest and to set maximums. So that right in the Texas legislature is limited only by the federal government through the Supremacy Clause. Whatever may be left of Texas statutes defining interest and setting limitations after the federal government has acted is absolutely in the ambit of the Texas legislature to maintain and hold. And what can that be? The Texas legislature has defined interest as the charges for the use, forbearance, or detention of money. That definition is at variance from all of the definitions by the federal government, which today boil down to APR and finance charges. Those concepts were engendered at about the time I started practicing law in the late 60s. One of the first things I did was draft documents for banks in San Antonio to comply with the new Truth in Lending Law. Now, those have now been in place some 20 years, and the concepts of APR and finance charge have become very well accepted, not just in the context of Truth in Lending, but in the context of other federal statutes, and in fact, in the context of the application of Texas statutes, plainly evidenced by this court's own opinion in Yates Ford versus Ramirez, where those concepts are, as defined in the federal law, were accepted. Now, the preemption statute was enacted. Contrary to counsel's representation of this court, the legislative history of that statute does contain information that the interest concept being utilized by the federal government in its preemption activity had to do with the annual percentage rate and the finance charge concepts. And it's right there in the first sentence of that counsel has quoted, that we have quoted in our brief, right there where the Court of Appeals cites. It says, in exempting mortgage loans from state usury limitations, the committee, this is the Senate committee, intends to exempt only, and that's in my brief, and the word only is underscored, only those limitations that are included in the annual percentage rate, period. Next sentence. The committee does not intend to exempt limitations on prepayment charges, attorney's fees, late charges, or similar limitations designed to protect borrowers by the states being my addition to the quote. So the legislative history of this statute exempts late charges from its coverage. Federal cases cited by us, let me back up just a moment. This court in Parks versus Lubbock, written by Chief Justice Gaines in 1899, a very short opinion, still cited by the courts of appeals, held that late charges wouldn't ordinarily be interest. That would have been deemed a penalty under the common law, under the rules of common law, is made interest under our statute. So the only reason that late charges are interest in Texas is because, and it goes on to show, that this is because of the use of the word detention in the legislative definition of interest. That word detention is not found in APR, it's not found in the concept of finance charge, it was found in the concept of common law penalty, but our legislature embraced it as it constitutionally had the power to do in the Texas definition of interest, and that's the only reason that it's there. The federal law then, when it preemptive interest ceilings has a plain history that whatever, if states were including late charges, prepayment penalties, or prepayment charges and attorney's fees as interest, they were not being preempted. That, of course, is cited. The federal law, the federal case of Vega that we cite in our brief, Vega versus First Federal Savings and Loan, plainly holds that a delinquency charge is not a finance charge if imposed for actual unanticipated late payment, delinquency, default, or such other occurrence.
Are you arguing that it's immaterial whether the state has opted out of the federal law, that it's simply late charges are just simply not covered by the federal law?
I believe when you look at the legislative history that was cited here and in the TMBA's brief, the Messer, it is not, I'm not able to argue that Texas explicitly opted out. The Texas legislature did act to regulate the same kind of loans that were previously preempted. I think, though, when you look at the history of that, you find that while so acting, the legislature expressed that it did not intend to opt out. Just like the federal legislative history shows that while acting to preempt interest, we are not preempting late charges. In other words, there is legislative history in both. And in my judgment, I cannot argue that Texas opted out of the federal preemption. But plainly, in my judgment, the federal preemption does not reach late charges. It's all over the federal cases. The reason that late charges are in Texas, the interest concept are explained historically in old Supreme Court cases and followed since, and the legislative history is clear. Now, why should not the state of Texas be permitted to regulate something like late charges? Here's the concept that was sought to be regulated and avoided. If you took a hypothetical Regulation Z disclosure, which would be page one of the handout that I gave, and I don't know exactly how to set this so that everyone can see it, but it's identical to what's before you. You would find that the amount to be paid if all payments are made as scheduled on this loan would be $95,809.44. The finance charge would be $11,502. Now the note in this case provides that in event, and it's in the transcript, it's attached to the brief in support of the motion for summary judgment and elsewhere in the transcript, but for ready reference. In the event any installment shall become overdue, any installment, the undersigned agrees to pay a late penalty of $20 per day for each day the payment is overdue. Each day the payment is overdue, when contracted for in the context of this case, means that if the first payment is overdue and the overdues continue through the loan, that these overdues accrue to a total of $182,420. With the federal exemption statute in place, it is my burden to show that the late charges, standing alone, and not accrued with interest charges, just those unregulated elements left by the federal government, exceed what a lender can charge in Texas. 18% would be what the lender could charge on this loan. This number exceeds 100%. It exceeds 200%. It so far outstrips what can be charged because $20 a day for every payment pyramided, as the plain language of this note calls for, puts it off the charts. And just the late charges, excising from the Texas concept of usury what's been preempted, are still usurious under the Texas limitations. What would that show, Mr. Badia, that he would have to pay? Well, it doesn't change the right-hand number because that disclosure says if you made all the payments as scheduled, still $95,000. But what it obscures is that now the interest and late charges loan contracted for are almost $194,000. That's contracted for. The Texas law is plain that contracted for, charged and received are disjunctive, and any one of those is violative of the state's usury law. Further evidence that the federal government intended not to regulate finance charges by presumption of preemption is found at the back of the very last brief filed by the petitioners here. In a letter referred to by them in argument, written by the acting general counsel of the Federal Home Loan Bank, and that counsel says, section 590.3C, and we're going to look at that in just a moment, identifies types of state borrower protection limitations that are not preempted by the act.
What is the state borrower protection limitation in Texas on late charges?
That the late charges contracted for cannot exceed the amount of the usury that's available to a lender. In other words, if the maximum that the lender can charge is 18%, the late charges cannot exceed 18%.
So if the interest rate is 17.5%, your late charges can't exceed 0.5%?
No. I appreciate the question because I'm not explaining myself very well. If the interest limitation is 18%, or the usury limitation is 18%, no amount of interest in the federal, no amount of finance charge can consume any of that because that's preempted by federal law. From 0 to 18% has to all be late charges. But if it is and it goes beyond that, it's usurious. And this case goes beyond that by double and more. And that charge, while including the Texas concept of interest and including the Texas concept of usury, is not preempted by federal law, and that charge standing alone exceeds what the legislature says a party can charge, in this case by more than double. Well, you can read what's highlighted here in their brief and in this opinion. But this very federal regulation, 590.3C of the Code of Federal Regulations, which is cited by a counsel in his letter, and what does that say? Well, this is the regulators writing their regulations under this statute. 509.3C, nothing in this section preempts limitations in state laws on prepayment charges, attorney's fees, late charges, are other provisions designed to protect borrowers, again, by the state. We're talking about preemption limitations in states. So the regulatory history, the regulations themselves, the Senate hearings, all say that late charges are not a part of the federal preemption. The federal cases, I want to further point out one other point here. In the case of Kissell Company, K-I-S-S-E-L-L Company versus Gressley, which is cited in our brief, is a case involving claims of usury and the defense of a savings clause in the contracts. In that case, the federal Ninth Circuit, citing Texas authorities, holds that whenever the contract between the parties plainly calls for a usurious rate of interest, a savings clause does not save it. So federal cases, as well as state cases, are cited by us to show that even the savings concept is not preempted by federal law, and that the Texas cases on that are as good federally as otherwise. The Court of Appeals opinion, in all respects, we submit has been properly decided. The judgment is properly decided, or the judgment properly disposes of these issues. There is, obviously, from the transcript, there are issues remaining in the trial court to be tried, and I therefore submit these remarks on behalf of the petitioner and the respondent stand for questions, if any.
Counsel, I'm not sure I thoroughly understood your response to the Chief Justice question a while ago. Walk me through that one more time. Let's for easy. I'm not sure where the late charges cut off. If the rate is 10% on $100, that's $10, how much late charge can you have if 10% is the limitation?
Well, there is no limitation.
Okay.
In this contract, and it's $20 per payment per month is what this contract calls for. When you add $20 per payment per month,
where does it get usurious then?
At 18%. Because 18% would otherwise control this loan in Texas.
Is that the monthly interest plus the late charge to reach 18%?
In Texas, that would be everything that could be included in the interest concept.
It's total. Okay.
Cannot exceed 18%. Now, in Texas today, the true interest, the finance charge, can no longer be regulated by that 18% limitation, because it's been federally preempted. So the only thing that can be regulated by the Texas 18% limitation is whatever's left after the federal preemption.
If they keep that below 18%, then they're home free.
If they keep the late charges below a possible ability of 18%, or whatever else, I mean, there are upfront charges, there's still some other things that are within the Texas concept that may not be within the federal concept. But the total, whatever's left of the state interest concept after the federal preemption is applied, if that altogether does not total over 18%, then the lender's on sound ground. But if it does, as in this case it does, the lender has still exceeded the Texas usury laws just by what's been left by the federal government for the state to regulate.
So it would almost no charge could have been made for late charges then?
Well, a charge could be made, actually a charge could be made here at 1.5% of the outstanding balance, because that couldn't total over 18% of the outstanding balance over 12 months. If that charge were made one time only, but when you start pyramiding like this calls for, any late payment, it's $20 per month for the payment that's late.
$20 per day.
Per day, I'm sorry. $20 per day for each day the payment is late. And then you miss another payment. Now you got $40 a day going. The next one you got $60 a day going, which is what this says. It runs off the charts and far exceeds 1.5% per month on the outstanding balance.
If it were $2 a day, you'd come up with, at the end of your, of all times, at $18,000, which would be just over the 18%, right?
Yes. Yes, Your Honor,
so
that's true.
So $2 a day would
almost work.
Almost. It's about $1.90 a day.
It certainly wouldn't be double.
I'm sure the court would take care of that under H-4 to say it's all de minimis.
Well, it certainly wouldn't be double at any rate. And that might be the way.
Any further questions?
Thank you very much for permitting me to submit the case.
Would you remove your poster?
Yes, I sure will.
First, I'll point out that Mr. Soles has spoken as though this $20 a day late charge pyramiding is a certainty under the contract. I hadn't addressed that in the first part of my argument, but I have addressed it in my brief, and I think it's pretty clear that that contract cannot be read to impose usurious late penalties. There were savings clauses contained in the deeds of trust which were carried forward through the modification and extension agreement, and I think the case law in Texas clearly holds that there is a presumption against usury, that the parties intended to obey the law, and unless it's manifest that they did not, there will not be a finding of usury. You have to read to get where he's going with the calculations that were shown on the disclosure statement, the sample disclosure statement. You have to read those late charges as being allowed to extend for the life of the loan and being pyramided on top of each other, $20 a day for the first month, $40 for the second, $60, and so on, to come up with the kind of figures that he's coming up with. I think that that clearly is not permissible under the contract. I've cited cases in the brief.
Can you just take a few minutes and show us the language of the contract
that talks about the savings, or I'm sorry?
The things you say are in the contract, it would be a savings clause.
Okay, there were savings clauses that are, I believe, that are cited. I'm trying to find my statement here of it. The savings clauses were contained in the deed of trust, and the modification and extension document carried forward the provisions of both the deeds of trust and the notes, except to the extent that, I believe there, let's see here, the savings clause language I've quoted on page 14 of the brief, and those savings clauses were carried forward in the modification and extension document, which states that all terms and provisions of said original notes and of the instrument or instruments creating or fixing the liens shall be and remain in full force and effect as therein written, except as otherwise expressly provided herein. So I think under the Texas law, I've cited several cases with regard to the contracted for usury. One of them is Grace, which dealt with a situation in which there was an $18,000 loan and a $500 handling charge. There was, the term of the loan was uncertain because the borrower, when they received a check, were supposed to forward it on to the lender. And the party that asserted usury relied on Shropshire, which says that a contract is usurious when there is any contingency by which the lender may get more than the lawful rate of interest. The Supreme Court in Grace distinguished the Shropshire case, saying that Shropshire dealt with contingencies that expressly entitled the creditor in the event of default to get more than the annual percentage rate. This case, I think, is much closer to the Grace case. You have to read that $20 a day late penalty provision as being allowed to go on and being pyramided. And
you're saying somebody with green eye shades back at the lender's office would note when the $20 got up to a maximum of 18% and would then just stop sending the bill?
Would stop. Well, I think you just read the contract. The argument is contracted for usurious interest, or as I also have argued, you read the contract itself, and the language of the contract does not allow you to take more than usurious interest. I think that's what the law says. Is that,
well,
you,
our consumer, as a practical matter, is going to realize when those late charges are aggregated up to the maximum amount that Texas non-preemptive law is charging of interest, and will then know. I'm wishing I knew about this the days I lived in an apartment. I mean, that I would know at some point to write in and say you can't charge me any more late charges.
Well, I don't think it's really a question of what the borrower knows. It's a question of looking strictly at the terms of the contract, because as I've also argued, there's been no allegation, no sufficient allegation in my mind, of a charge of usurious interest. It's contracted for usurious interest. And so you're looking just at the document itself and seeing whether or not you can read that document to say that there was contracted for usurious interest.
So and almost I'm just trying to understand this. On almost any contract, you could set up a panoply of payment schemes, and then if you have in the contract, however, none of this shall be read to exceed the maximum rate of legally charged interest under the laws of the state of Texas, then as long as no charge is made, there's been no contract for usurious interest.
No, I don't read the law that way. I think if it expressly entitles you, if you said that in the event of default, assuming that the federal preemption didn't apply, and you said in the event of default, the lender shall be entitled to collect 50% on it, I think that no savings clause is going to help you in that case. It helps in cases where you have to read, you know, $20 becomes $40, becomes $60, where it's not clear that you can get it, and the law implies a presumption.
But why isn't this clear? What in here keeps it from,
what in here keeps it from
being clear that Mr. Soule's worst-case charge is not going to be what happened?
Well, I think the law reads it that way to say that there is no, that the $20 a day has to read only until you've got,
until you reach the
maximum limit.
Well, it's the maximum limit thing. So the first $20 can aggregate it. You can go to 20 and 40 and then 60. And then
I don't read the document necessarily to mean that, but assuming that that's what you could read it to mean, I think that the law says that you don't read it that way.
Well, we're dealing with a summary judgment case here, and as the Court of Appeals observed when they addressed this issue, burden on you is to totally negate 100%. And you're saying that it's susceptible of two different readings. Doesn't that create a fact issue that has to be resolved?
No, I don't believe it does, because I think that read with the law contracted for usury, that it becomes unambiguous, and therefore that you don't have a fact question to be resolved. I think that in a contracted for interest situation, read with the cases that I've cited, you don't have a fact issue. And I've also cited there was some claim made during the Court of Appeals argument that there was charged usurious interest, and for the reasons that I've cited in my brief, which basically has to do with the way the issue was raised, I don't think that has been sufficiently raised, that issue. I think that they had a duty under the Clear Creek Basin decision and under another decision, Holmes, out of the Dallas Court of Appeals, to specifically point to what in that affidavit they claimed constituted charged usurious interest, and there was nothing in the written responses to either the trial court or to the Court of Appeals, and the Supreme Court has said that there is no duty to sift the record and try to determine whether or not there are issues that are going to come up later on appeal, and they didn't raise them.
What did they raise? Was it the preemption question alone?
I'm sorry?
What issue did the respondents here raise in response to summary judgment of the trial court?
Well, they responded to both, because we raised the federal preemption question and alternatively the state question.
One of the chief fringe benefits of just this job is hopefully we learn something from every case. And so educate me a little on your statement that this has nothing to do with what the borrower understands. Did I understand you to say that correctly?
Well,
the Truth in Lending Act?
Oh, no, I was talking in the context of state law on usury, whether or not contracted for interest fell within that, and he was, I think, asking me whether or not the borrower is supposed to call in and say, you know, I've reached my limit now, and the only thing that I was dealing with was the issue of looking at the contract itself, which will be read from just determining the contract in the light of the applicable law. I mean, I didn't raise that with...
Would a logical extension of that be that the lender can put anything in that contract they can get by with as long as they can hide a savings clause, and even though the borrower understands if my payment is due on the 1st and I don't get it in by the 5th, I must send an extra $100. That you can hide a savings clause somewhere in there, and it's King's X.
No, I don't think it comes out that way, because I think that if in fact the Siders had charged this interest and had just kept accepting late payments, $20 a day, month after month after month, you'd have a whole separate question. And
but giving them the ability to do it, isn't that the problem?
I think that the law says that you don't read that contract that way, that isn't giving them the ability to do that under
statement. It presumes that you won't read it that way.
It presumes against usury, and especially with a savings clause, when it's not expressed that you can take more than the legal rate of interest. And I think that the Fischel case and W. Grace both support that.
I don't understand this clearly, and it's my fault and not yours. Let me take some of your time. What point are you saying that the respondents did not raise in their response to your motion for summary judgment that is thereby waived?
I think that they didn't clearly raise, as they have to do under the summary judgment rules, charged usurious interest. I would point out that neither...
How about contracted for?
Yes, they did raise...
They raised that, but they raised you say when we read the contract, with your presumptions, with your case, that we don't get contracted for.
I think that, but I think that they were attempting to also say that the Siders charged usurious interest, and I don't think that has been sufficiently raised under the law.
Well, I didn't hear respondent arguing the charge.
I don't know, but it was argued at the Court of Appeals level.
Any further
I was just going to point out too that with regard to again to emphasize that with regard to the second sentence, going back to the federal preemption that says we don't intend to exempt limitations on late charges, there again you have a situation where Texas does not separately regulate late charges. It defines them as interest. And I think that if you say that the only things that are included within the preemption are those things defined by an annual percentage rate, the annual percentage rate under the Truth in Lending Act and under Regulation Z, a lot of loans that were made with the intention and the belief that they were preempted, that the interest ceilings were preempted, are going to become usurious. That reasoning extends not only to late charges, because there are a number of loans that don't fall under Truth in Lending Act, the contingent interest type situation that I was talking about. If you say that you have to straitjacket the language of the statute by saying that it's only things that are included in the annual percentage rate, then you are saying that a lot of other forms of interest are usurious in Texas.
I don't follow your argument here. You're contending the fact that Texas does not regulate late charges differently than it regulates interest, thereby means that these are not late charges, even though you call them late charges. Is that what you're saying?
No, that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that I think that the legislative history, you have to read both of those sentences together. And when they say they intend to include charges included in the annual percentage rate, I think probably what they meant by annual percentage rate was, you know, rate per year as defined in a usury statute. And then saying in distinction to that, that when you separately limit late charges and that sort of thing, that those are not intended to be preempted. But Texas does not separately regulate those. And I assume that the legislature could separately regulate them.
But the fact that we don't separately regulate them, does it change their character as a late charge?
It doesn't change their character. They are late charges, but they are also interest. And therefore, I believe they fall within the preemption of interest, discount points, finance charges, and other
things. Even though Congress is saying we're not including late charges.
I think that sentence almost has to be read to say that it's late charges in states that separately regulate late charges. Because if you read it with interest, Texas defines late charges as interest.
Any further questions? Thank you very much. That concludes the business of the court for the day.